You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly audio news digest. On today's broadcast, we'll talk to school board member Kim Gray and city council member Bruce Tyler about the Bon Secours Redskins deal. We'll also speak to Eva Roach and Harry Kulitz Jr. about Richmond's new league of lady arm wrestlers, Rawful. And we'll talk to Jackie O'Connor and James Ricks of the Henley Street Theater Company about Henley Street's forthcoming season. But first, here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling announced Wednesday that he'll not run for the governor's seat in 2013, citing the state GOP's decision to choose a nominee through a convention process rather than a statewide primary vote. Bowling's plans were derailed by Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli's unexpected entry into the race, but the decision by the state Republican Rulemaking Central Committee to use a convention process rather than a primary greatly favors the more conservative Cuccinelli. Bowling has not ruled out a third-party candidacy. He also declined to endorse fellow Republican Cuccinelli, saying he has reservations about Cuccinelli's leadership. City Council unanimously approved measures this week that paved the way for a Redskins training camp in Richmond. Concerns from several council members and the public threatened to delay the deal, but weekend negotiations led by Councilman Chris Hilbert made enough progress to garner support from the entire council. Citizens at Monday's session both offered support and criticized the city's handling of the deal, saying the process was rushed and hushed. Hilbert had opposed the lease of the historic West Hampton School to Bon Secours Health Systems rather than an outright sale. The lease skirted a 2008 ordinance that would have required money from the sale of the property to go back into Richmond Public Schools. The newly amended agreement commits Bon Secours to a 10-year, $1 million deal for capital school projects. In return for the lease of the West Hampton property, Bon Secours will build and sponsor the Redskins training camp behind the Science Museum of Virginia. Bon Secours must still go through the special use permit process for the renovation of the school. Hilbert says City Council will grant them no guarantees. VCU women's volleyball head coach James Finley says he believes his sexual orientation played a role in the university's decision not to renew his contract. Finley, who is openly gay, learned last week that his 8-year coaching career at VCU is effectively over after being told by athletic director Ed McLaughlin that the university wanted to go in a different direction. This follows a 25-6 season that VCU's own athletics department website calls historic. According to interviews with NBC 12 and GayRVA.com, Finley says AD McLaughlin has shown a pattern of being uncomfortable with openly gay and lesbian staff, and that the university has opened an investigation into the decision. In statements, both McLaughlin and the university say they are committed to the university policies barring discrimination based on sexual orientation. The James River Shorts Festival will shine on the silver screen tonight at the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. The annual two nights of abbreviated cinema put on by the James River Film Society will showcase motion pictures under 30 minutes in length. The juried competition has scheduled 12 finalists, from experimental films to documentaries to animated efforts. A reception and holiday party tomorrow night at the Visual Arts Center of Richmond will feature short films of juror Lynn Elliott and honorable mention efforts. More information is at jamesriverfilm.org. A significant drop in abuse and neglect petitions filed by the City Department of Social Services on behalf of children is the subject of an investigation by the state DSS. CBS 6 reports that City Councilman Chris Hilbert approached Mayor Dwight Jones following complaints from doctors of abused and neglected children repeatedly being returned to potentially dangerous homes. A call from Jones to state social services prompted the state to open an investigation. For Open Source RVA, I'm Mike McKenzie.
Richmond finally got its wish for a professional football team this past Monday when City Council, which appeared set to intercept a major Hail Mary play by Mayor Dwight Jones, instead helped carry the ball over the goal line in a unanimous vote. That vote moves into place all the pieces of a complicated multi-million dollar deal that has Bon Secours Richmond Health System taking possession of the old West Hampton School in exchange for its financial support in constructing the new Redskins practice facility on Lee Street behind the Science Museum of Virginia. But while there were at least three winners in this game,
the mayor, the Catholic Hospital Group, and the Professional Football Organization, every game has its losers. In this case, Richmond Public Schools, which had long been promised the proceeds from the eventual sale of the West Hampton School, will never know what the building might actually have fetched on the open market. It was assessed by the city at about $7.5 million. The mayor's initial plan had schools getting a few thousand dollars a year for the property. The city council broker deal has schools faring better, about $6.3 million over 10 years. But is it enough for a school system already stressed by budget shortfalls, falling test scores, failing infrastructure, and a teaching staff being asked to do more for less? I'm here with Bruce Tyler, 1st District Councilman, and with Kim Gray, who's 2nd District School Board, and we're here talking a little bit about the vote that's gone down with the Redskins and Bon Secours deal. And welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I guess first off, just wanted to talk a little bit about the, I don't know, 11th hour nature of the final vote on this ordinance. And that was, it really came down to the wire. It was a clincher, it looked like.
Well, it was a very compressed time to have conversations about it. Quite frankly, it was going to be 11th hour conversation just because of the, from the time the ordinance was introduced to the time it actually was brought through council was 2 weeks. And so the minute we walked out of chambers, we had to begin the discussions, and that started the next day.
At first, in fact, right up until the 11th hour, it looked like this was going to be something that could be a no vote. There were four of you that were fairly solid going into the weekend, I think.
Yeah, there were four of us who had great reservations about what was going on. My personal perspective, it was a very poor real estate deal. Probably was one of the worst negotiated deals that I'd ever seen in real estate. And I've got a background of 30 years in real estate and have watched a lot of transactions occur. Unfortunately, the mayor was willing to do anything to get this deal across the table, and he thought he had the votes from day one and put this deal together. And quite frankly, the deal was poorly conceived, and it put the schools out in the cold. With that being said, fortunately, there were four of us that were willing to say, wait a minute, we need to step back and figure out how to make this thing right.
Now, that really was one of the most surprising parts of the entire puzzle that was assembled here for, I think, a lot of the public, was the how out in the cold that schools were left.
Mm-hmm.
Kim, I guess we'll get to you in a moment, but Bruce, with your real estate background, and actually Kim may be able to answer this as well with a real estate background, that building, it seemed like as the conversation went on, public conversation went on, the valuation on that building, according to the city administration, kept dropping.
Well, you've got to look at it a couple of different ways. First of all, the total parcel, which includes the playing fields, actually was about $7 million. The school structure in the 4 acres was roughly $4 million of that seven. The reality is that when you look at real estate deals, you have to look at what use is going to be proposed. When you're talking about a gas station going on a corner like a Wawa or Sheetz, they're going to or a drugstore, you're going to see a very high value per acre, which easily is $4 million. You flip it around and you look at a medical office building and you're looking at about a $2 million transaction. And then you have to look at the cap rates and decide where the cap rates are and do computations that basically give you a value. And when you did that, basically you've got a building that you should be getting somewhere between $50,000 and $75,000 a year for a land lease. So again, all real estate transaction, straight up stuff done every day, everywhere. And you just got to understand how these deals come together.
When I look at that area, though, I guess with what you were up to over there, trying to deal with some of the special use permits and the weird zoning that had mm-hmm. been going on over the years over in that area and cleaning that up.
Yes.
Which you'd been very much involved in. And
2.5 years.
Lauded and applauded by the community over there. You had a number of recent condo cases that were coming before you had the BP. For a brief time, the West Hampton Theater was looked at as possibly a condo project. Of course, again, the Tiber is one that hopefully will move forward at some point in the future. And that one you're looking at million-dollar, multi-million-dollar units. Mm-hmm. This school being the historic building that it is, would that not have been something that, that some developers would have been circling like vultures?
Or? Well, from day one, once the school was surplus, I had developers calling me and asking when it was it going to come out. I would go to the administration and say, when are you going to put this out? Well, the real estate market's not right. We need to hold off. The reality is that in my mind, the building should have been sold day one. The big discussion is with the, when you look at a tax credit deal, which these condos would have been, the city's tax piece of it would have gone away because of the rehab. You would have had 10 years of real estate taxes not being paid by the developer or the owners of the condos or whatever the multifamily units would be. So having the buildings there is not an incentive in terms of taxes increasing. So having a new building there obviously weighs in the, that direction, which then gets into the conversation of money that we're going to be sending over to Richmond Public Schools.
Now, Kim, you still object to the deal as it stands, correct?
Well, number one, you don't know what the true market value is if you never put it on the market. That's the number one point. So we can make estimations on what we think that it was valued and whether or not it was worth $7 million or $4 million, we won't ever know that. And the assessed value for the total parcel was $7.5 million. We were urged, before I was even sworn in to the board in 2008, to begin the process for moving kids, having public hearings, closing the school down, moving the kids out. And because of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and the millions of dollars it was going to cost us to get that building remediated, we were urged to move out of that building. And we were told at the time that there were very active negotiations going on with Bon Secours. So, you know, to say that there weren't, you know, things already happening for years prior to when this deal came forward. And what we do know is that Bon Secours was really willing to put over $6 million into the development project on Lee Street. So I've got to at least think that part of that money would have come back to schools if they had paid outright for that property instead of having gotten a 60-year lease.
Now, Bruce, Kim brought up the reality, I guess, that Bon Secours had been very interested in the building. When I was at Style, we did a piece about Peter Bernard's very, very active interest, this Peter Bernard being the head of Bon Secours, interest in doing a mixed-use new urbanism development back in that area. You had a public meeting with your constituents within days of the announcement of this, right?
What happened was the Wednesday before the Monday announcement, the civic associations that located east of Bon Secours, we were meeting with Bon Secours, going over the hospitality house, which is a residence for folks who come to the city, have family members at the hospital, and they need to be close by. And Bon Secours was in the process of a special use permit. One of the individuals at the meeting asked the representative of Bon Secours if anything was happening with the school, and this individual has said nothing was happening. So
And I've been to at least one community meeting that you've held where Bon Secours was there and they were saying nothing active right now.
But in this case, it was 4 days before the announcement occurred. And when the announcement occurred, everyone in that neighborhood felt they were betrayed. And this is a neighborhood that is, average house is $200,000. People get up every morning and go to work. This is probably their biggest asset in their life. And to have the trust broken between the community and Bon Secours was a tough discussion. So from my perspective, the first thing that had to happen is the neighborhood needed to be represented and protected. And that's where I began in this conversation.
So there's going to be some Bon Secours folks who will need to head to confession.
Well, I asked the sisters to hold off on the deal to try to get some time where we could kind of make things work together in a way that was not down at the council chambers. Bonds Corps and the sisters chose not to do that. So that put us in the pressure cooker for the negotiations that we ultimately had.
Now, as you worked this deal out, again, back to our final couple of days before this thing came together, you worked out a deal that was presented as being equitable to schools. And I'd like to ask both of you, I guess maybe start with Kim, do you feel the deal that was worked out was equitable? In terms of returning some of what was taken away with the initial deal, I think the initial deal was what, $5,000 a
year? Well, I think it went from
zero, really.
I think it went from being out in the cold to being lukewarm. It's still not enough, in my opinion, to compensate us for the property. We have very limited amounts of properties that we can surplus at this point. And I believe the spirit of the ordinance was to make up for the years and decades of underinvestment in our schools. So to say we get $4 million over 10 years, and that's contingent upon all of these projections coming forward and making sure that, you know, the revenues come in from all these sources, from the development that's going to happen in 2 to 3 years, from the Redskins having 100,000 people show up every day, from, you know, I think that there are a lot of questions that I have. I don't know if it's a guaranteed amount, if it's contingent upon whether or not the revenue is what they projected it to be. And to get it over 10 years as opposed to a lump amount, which would have happened if we had sold the property outright, we would have gotten that money into our coffers for capital improvements. We could have made our athletic fields what we know they should be. There are lots of things, technology improvements. There's so many needs within our schools, immediate needs, that no, I don't think that satisfies what the spirit of that ordinance set forward.
Bruce?
Well, I think if you were to look at it and follow the ordinance, it would be the cleanest way to handle the situation. This is a close second in my book for a couple reasons. The first being is that $1 million is coming in to schools over a 10-year period from Bonds Corps Foundation. They're dedicating the tax revenue, which is about $280,000 a year once those buildings are built, into the school system. So you've got 8 years of that, so that's $2.4 million. So that gets you to 3.4 pretty quickly.
And here are the buildings you're talking about are the buildings that are behind the science museum.
No, that's building. Actually the buildings
medical,
on the site.
Medical buildings.
And then you throw in the proceeds from, and those projections I think are as wide open. So does it get to the 4 million? I think it eventually will, but it won't be a lump sum. Ultimately, it would have been easier and cleaner for the schools to receive the money. And I'm the first one to say that would have been the best deal. In fact, I have had a paper in fact do that long before all this started, which was tabled while this occurred. So you know, I'm in the same camp initially, but when I knew I wasn't going to get that, then I had to go and figure out what was going to be, what we could do to, one, protect the neighborhood, which was to get historic designation on the building, in the sense that they're going to look at salvaging the building first. They can't do that, then they will look at the facades. If they can't do that, then they will tear it down. They are going to work asking, they have asked Historic Richmond to be involved in it, so there'll be an independent party to study it. So that was for protection of the neighborhood. The flip side was getting this money to the schools. And I think at the end of the day, we got to a good deal, not a great deal, a good deal.
Can I jump in?
Sure.
Because I think the other piece that was insulting was that we kept hearing that we're getting 4 new schools, as if this is some, you know, additional thing that's coming out of this deal. It had nothing. We have anyone in the city knows we are long overdue.
And
for
I was going to get
buildings.
To that. There's some that already we've had some money taken out of.
We've had millions of dollars taken out of these projects because they said, oh, we don't have enough to put all the windows into this high school, or we're going to take some of the landscaping out of the deal. We're going to take some amenities out. So we've been told over the past year that there wasn't enough money to do all of the beautiful things in this building that we were expecting from the site plans and the architectural drawings. And then to read the ordinance from the other night that says they're going to move $5.6 million out of the school construction fund and put it towards building this complex for the Redskins, on top of not getting the money off of the West Hampton deal, it's insult to injury. So, you know, there are lots of things that dig at me when we start talking about whether or not we got a fair deal here.
Now that $5 million is borrowed money that will go back.
Well, it was all borrowed. It was supposed to go back. Now that way it's structured, it'll fall in future bonds. But I think Kim has a very good point. First of all, the four schools were online, had nothing to do with this deal, and in fact, the two elementary schools, the middle school, and the high school were all in the hopper long before this deal ever showed up. And to make it sound like this was all part of the grandiose plan, she's absolutely right. They should have never been brought up. It was apples and oranges. Those deals were cut. They were cut because they needed to be done, should have been done long before they were done. The flip side is that this administration, in my opinion, made some very poor choices on how they actually procured the schools. And as a result, the schools are paying the price for having to take quality out of some of the buildings and not get everything that they anticipated. And these are the things that have been going on behind the scenes. We've got a company out of a D.C. that we're paying large sums of money, never can get the real answer from the administration now how much has been paid, even though I asked on multiple occasions.
Now, which company is this?
I'm not sure the name of it, but they have about a $6 million contract with the schools
to do the
project management.
Okay.
And quite frankly, we could have done the project management with an in-house team, hired people and brought them on and saved the...
We've
had this conversation.
Yeah, we ended those positions. There were three of them, I think,
yeah.
Were project
managers. And, as it turns out, they were supposed to really be the top notch. Well, the first two elementary schools came in way over budget. They had to do all kind of value engineering, which means cheaping the building up. And at the end of the day, we didn't get what we had bargained for, in my opinion. So Kim and I are in agreement on a lot of this.
Now the ordinance, there's a couple of ordinances here involved, but the ordinance that guaranteed that a surplus building's proceeds would go to schools, this is one that the administration was aware of and that they've now essentially said, well, yeah, we knew that this was not violating the law, but it was violating the spirit of that ordinance. Mm-hmm. Sorry, we fooled you. We didn't mean to. Let's go back and fix it. Is that good enough to...
I don't believe that. I believe from day one they knew exactly what they were doing, and they did it because they wanted to cut the deal for the Redskins, and they were willing to do anything. They didn't give a hoot about Richmond Public Schools on this issue. They were looking for the way to make it happen.
But when we talk about Richmond Public Schools, we're talking about children. And when we're looking at what we can do to make the city the best city it can be, I love Bon Secours. I use them for all of my children's ailments. I love the Redskins and football. But the best thing we can do
You're
for this
red.
City... Yes, the best investment, and I've said it before, the best capital investment we can ever make is in our people, and our people, it's our little people, our children. And when we shortchange them, and when we put cinder blocks instead of windows in their buildings, we're really telling them what we think about them. And we may not think that they realize this, but I say it all the time, when our kids get on a bus to go play football against a school in Henrico, and they arrive at a deep run, and they look at the facilities there, it tells them a story, and it gives a message to them that they're not as valuable. And I think that we need to start looking at ourselves as a city and we need to put some ethical decision making in how we talk to our children and what we give them and how we offer our educational system to them, because it ultimately will come back to bite us.
Going back to the ordinance, really, at the end of the day, there still also is the state constitution to deal with here too, right? I mean, there's some questions as to whether or not any of the way that this school is being dealt with are legal.
I'm not sure about that. My feeling is at this point we've gotten over that hurdle. I don't know that anybody's going to challenge it. I trust the city attorney on his thought process on this, so I'll defer to the legal eagles.
Well, the other piece to add is that we are now being urged to surplus other valuable properties in that region on the Boulevard corridor, and I want to make sure that City Council is there backing our school district and seeing that these deals don't come through like this anymore.
And these two buildings, of course, are the Arlington Road.
And Arthur Ashe.
And Arthur Ashe. And Arlington Road is a huge, huge, huge,
huge facility.
Warehouse.
And we've already agreed to vacate the White House, the warehouse there at Parker Field where the baseball diamond sits. So I think that there are some things that we need to be thinking about moving forward. Although I'm still disappointed about this deal, it's a done deal, and we need to position ourselves so that we do see some benefit from surplusing these properties, because I'm all about finding efficiencies in schools and making sure that the bulk of the money we spend goes towards improving and moving us to the 21st century and making sure that our operations money is going into instruction and not into keeping up old buildings. But, you know, we did that in good faith. We surplused West Hampton, and look at what happened. So I want to make sure that City Council understands, the mayor's administration understands, and the city as a whole, that this should be a priority for us.
Does City Council understand, Bruce?
I think the members of City Council understand it, and that's why this whole situation occurred. If they hadn't, then we would have never had this dialogue. So I feel confident there are enough members on council that they will, in fact, continue to try to figure out ways to support the schools and champion. I mean, every person that ran basically said Richmond public schools are important. And so with that dialogue in hand, I think the school board has a golden opportunity to cash in on this discussion and really put them to the test. And I think that's the key to the conversation. There's a critical thing that has really nothing to do with West Hampton School, but has to do with our schools. Last year, we basically short-funded Richmond Public Schools by about $5 million in my book, which basically furloughed teachers. And while we're sitting here, it's critical for the folks to understand that $5 million was then taken out of the system. The teachers were all given a pay cut. And you've got teachers that are qualified that are now out looking for the next job outside of the Richmond Public Schools. I've had folks tell me that are in Richmond Public Schools that they're going to lose teachers because of this.
Absolutely.
And the reality of the situation is this upcoming new council and new school board are going to have to figure this out quickly, or else we're going to lose people. Now, the good news is, and I hope the school board will lobby this or take the money. Monday night, City Council ended up taking additional funds that the state gave us for, they had estimated 1.9, but they ended up at 4.4. So you got about $2.3 million. And I really would encourage the school board to take that $2.3 million, which is above what they were anticipating, and turn around and give it to the salaries to the teachers.
I have been advocating for that. I would like to see a reinstatement of the remainder of those, because the 5-day furlough constituted a 3% pay cut. And Bruce and I are agreeing so much tonight. I'm really shocked.
She's not shocked. She knows better than that.
Is this Friday the 13th? Yeah. Is it just 2013's around the corner? Is the Mayan calendar is about to end?
I'm working on the election.
All right. Well, again, Bruce Tyler, 1st District City Councilman. Thank you for joining us. And Kim Gray, 2nd District School Board member. Again, thanks for coming in to talk with us over here at Open Source a little bit about this pivotal vote, frankly, that brings us the Redskins, but also leaves us with many questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Richmond, are you ready to rumble? Hopefully that's not copywritten, and if it is, I feel safe knowing the ladies of Raffle, Richmond Arm Wrestlers for Ladies, will settle all legal claims against me. Raffle is almost exactly what it sounds like, a band of amazing women with superhuman strength and ultra-punned names, prepared to set their combined superhero strength to the task of raising money for women-centered organizations like Safe Harbor. As with this Saturday, December 1 at Balasso at 7 p.m., where you can, as the general public, arrive, pay $8 admission, and watch Raffle make its debut exhibition match. It's certain to make the likes of Hulk Hogan or Rowdy Roddy Piper wet their star-spangled spandex drawers, and I'm here right now with one of Raffle's wrestlers, Amazonia, as well as with the evening's MC, whose fanciful superhero name is Harry Kolatz.
Junior, Chris, I don't want my father blamed or credited for this event.
Welcome, guys. And tell me, what is this Raffle? And Amazonia, tell me a bit about how you landed here on our shores. All right, well, that's difficult to get. Luckily, Amazonia has brought her translator, Ava. Ava, nice to see you today. Can you tell me a little bit about Raffle? Obviously, we're having a little bit of fun here in the studio.
Yeah, well, this is an initiative by many women, some artists, some women related to nonprofit, to get together and raise money to other nonprofits by doing some army wrestling. It's a kind of theatrical and funny event, a way to empower women to just to find the best way.
All or most of the arm wrestlers are local artists?
Yeah. Many local artists, or they are working somehow with art, with nonprofits, with some
and of course you're
very
with,
strong women.
Both with Vakla, you're co-founder of Vakla, as well as an artist, and you're with the VMFA, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then Harry, I don't know how in the world you got involved with this. I understand you have a little
I do what women tell me, Chris. I was told to be in this organization, and so I am. But you know, are you ready to raffle Richmond?
I don't know if Richmond is ready to raffle.
Oh, they're going to encounter many beasts, that I can tell.
Some strange women, right? I understand that there's some interesting names, and we won't go into too many of them. I don't know if they're
This is a family station, isn't it?
It's exactly. How did that happen? I don't know if it's fit for air. But, I mean, this is an interesting organization in that it's not just here in Richmond, right? This is
not
something that started
not just in Richmond. Charlottesville was one of the first places, and then there were 19.
Claw was that organization?
Claw, yes.
Claw, and that's the Charlottesville Ladies.
Charlottesville Ladies of Arm Wrestling, yes.
There are around 19 leagues in the whole country, and it's been just a funny way to do. And it works well.
It's a great idea. It's a fun event. I'm an organizer of Hamaganza, which is an upcoming benefit concert sponsored actually by Open Source. That's going to be December 7th and 8th, and you guys are going to be there for us trying to raise money for the food bank too, which I guess is not a totally women-centered organization, but they certainly help women as well.
It's
you guys
a funny
are,
way. This is a theatrical way, but it is a way to really have everybody participating and doing that in a funny way, not to take yourself
too seriously. And you're going to be doing a lot of grunting
doing grunting. I am a beast from the Amazon. I was raised by cheetahs.
We should stop here real quick. Not you, right? This is
Amazonia,
who you're
your dark brown hair. Right.
You are currently holding a chain that is restraining Amazonia here in the studio.
Don't get too close. Get that guy with the taser. We may need it.
Keep her back. Well, can you tell us again a little bit more about Amazonia? She's from the Amazon.
She is from the Amazon. She was raised in the heart of the Amazon. She drank the milk from the cheetahs. She slept among the porcupines. She bathed with the pythons and anacondas.
And probably got some wrestling experience with the anacondas.
Really built upper body strength wrestling pythons.
She ate a lot of civilized men.
Oh, she ate them.
Holy and until she was captured and has been fighting arenas and places.
Ever since. Then. But she does it for a good cause now, though, right?
She does for a very good cause. Yeah, and there are some things that can make the Amazon very mad. And
hopefully it's not hairy.
Oh.
Well, I'm only there to support and assist them in any way they wish.
Some of the other characters we can talk about. One, in fact, I'm going to be fighting against her, Camila Toe.
She's
yes.
fierce, Chris, and
you have
strong.
To see the size of her personality.
Her personality is that what
she has a massive big. Personality.
It's big.
So and again, this is all camp. The whole idea of this is you come.
Oh yeah.
And you're engulfed in the campiness of this very much WWE sort of
Chris,
style.
We have among the roster of fighters Bruisin' B. Anthony, which is a good thing, you know, because I support a woman's right to bear arms, particularly if they're arm wrestling and they're fighting each other. I'm particularly interested in seeing how the Swiss misfit acquits herself. She's going to do very well, I think, in this heat.
So what were you saying, Ava?
I was just going to say that I'm going to be fight against Camila Toe. That's actually the artist Heidi Trepanier, a very good artist, local artist in Richmond.
Now, are you guys bringing any of the art to these shows, or are you going totally lowbrow for the purpose of the wrestling?
Lowbrow?
What do you mean by lowbrow?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's such a man.
This is performance art, right?
High camp is not lowbrow, Chris.
Well, guys, and again, you guys are not going to just be doing this one event. You're doing, of course.
We're going to be doing many events. Hopefully, we're going to be able to raise money to other nonprofits. I think everybody should come. It's going to be fun. It's going to be theatrical. It's going to be hilarious. We encourage many to come and of course to come. You can bet on the people,
you know, and we've totally forgot about that. You'll be able to buy raffle bucks, I think, which will then allow you to bet on the event, and as I understand, some of these MCs and your referees aren't necessarily so scrupulous, so if somebody happens
to mean by scrupulous,
slide
Chris?
A couple extra raffle bucks towards the referee or to the MC, maybe
my character is beyond repute.
Maybe the match might go very well for Amazonia or.
Of course it will. Chris, it's going to be knuckle crunching, bicep bulging, wrist slamming action. That's what it's going to be.
It sounds like it's worth as many raffle bucks as you can.
As many raffle bucks as you can possibly buy.
Now, be careful. Be very careful, you all men, because those women, they are crazy.
When they get into their furious battle mode.
Have you ever seen a woman mad? Oh.
All right. Well,
fierce, Chris.
And with that, it is time to go. Ava and, excuse me, Amazonia. Not Ava. Amazonia. And, of course, Harry Kolatz Jr.
Thank you again.
Thank you so much with Raffle.
We hope to see everybody there.
Let's see, what is it? Richmond
Arm Wrestlers for Ladies.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Get ready to raffle, Richmond.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, call 804-771-5715 or visit www.kaufmanandknowles.com. Broadcast of WRIR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
In many
ways, the Henley Street Theater Company brings back that time-honored traveling thespian tradition, performing a wide range of works in different settings for diverse audiences. A nomadic tribe without a permanent home, but with a mission statement that seeks to keep regional theater vibrant, exciting, even dangerous, Henley's choices can range from crowd-pleasing, large-cast farces like The Liar, a bawdy adaptation of a 17th-century comedy, to intimate character studies such as the powerful racial drama Yellow Man. Henley has also put its indelible stamp on war horses, such as Waiting for Godot, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and True West. The Richmond-based company is the brainchild of managing director Jackie O'Connor and artistic director James Ricks, two veterans of River City's close-knit theater community who stress their mutual love of Shakespeare by, as Hamlet would say, suiting the action to the word and the word to the action. This has helped them to gain a reputation in the area as a performing arts company worth subscribing and paying attention to. Henley Street's sixth season kicks off next week with Jane Wagner's The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, opening at the Dorothy Gottwald Playhouse at Center Stage on December 6th. And we welcome Henley Street Theater's Jackie O'Connor and James Ricks to Open Source RVA. Welcome you two.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Hey, tell me a bit about your backgrounds. Both of you have been involved in regional theater for a while. Jackie, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, I came to Richmond a little over 25 years ago now. Gosh, time flies. I started touring with Theater 4 right after graduating from Shenandoah University and was lucky enough to continue working in Richmond Theater through performing at most of the major theater companies here. And then I slipped into the back door, started working for Barksdale Theater as their box office manager and kind of worked my way up and learned the back end of the business and was just blessed with wonderful mentors like Bruce Miller and Phil Whiteway and just, you know, Tom Wyeth, the greats of Richmond, and learned my craft that way.
James, you don't keep this a secret. You're Canadian.
I am Canadian.
Tell me about your tell me about your acting background, and I'm guessing Donald Sutherland was a huge influence.
Well, I've been in the States for a while. I'm originally from Victoria, British Columbia, but I came down to the States once I finished high school to go to university. And then I moved straight to New York, was there for many years working in television and theater before I got lured further south to Washington, D.C., where I did my graduate work at the Shakespeare Theater. So actually, I've only been in Richmond for 4 years in the entire time with Henley Street Theater.
Had you directed before you came to Richmond?
Yes. I've directed in D.C. and in Baltimore and even here in Richmond before I took on this job.
Well, what was the impetus behind starting Henley Street? Why did Richmond need another theater company?
Well, the company was founded originally by a guy named Alex Prevetera, who moved here from Chicago, and he wanted to start up an ensemble-style theater company, kind of like the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago, where you have an ensemble, kind of collective of artists that are the mainstay throughout any season. And the company did that for the first few years, and we've since sort of moved away from that just because we think Richmond is a bit small for that kind of work.
Or to do that exclusively, right?
Exactly, yeah. You don't want to create an island unto yourself too much in a community like this. So,
right.
Yeah. But that's where it started.
Well, what have you learned going into this season coming up that you didn't know when you started the company? You've gained wisdom how and in what way?
Well, I think our motto, in addition to always coming back to the mission and re-looking at the mission every couple of years, is slow and steady wins the race, really. You don't want to grow too fast and grow out of your means. A lot of theater companies get into trouble early on with overspending. You want to honor your patrons, your donors, and the city by being consistent in your product. And
your seasons are generally 4, 5, 6 works, right?
Exactly. We'll usually do 4 or 5. We also do a lot of free theater, which is part of our mission. We'll do the bootleg each year. This year we did Hamlet, and that's a very unique offering that we do for the city. But we want to keep growing, and in order to do that, we just have to really be mindful. And I think that that's probably the thing I'm most proud of, is that we are not a theater company that is in debt. We are always, we're growing. Every year we grow in leaps and bounds. But I want to make sure that we are still here tomorrow. So, you know, we need our home. We need a permanent space. We need things like that. But we'll get there. We'll get there.
How much of the not being in debt is owed to the fact that you don't have a regular venue that you have to keep up, that you own and have to make payments on, or
that's
what have you?
Absolutely true. I mean, that's
you have to rent to own.
The one benefit of being homeless is that we're not beholden to any kind of, you know, mortgage situation or you know, utility bills and whatnot. I mean, we're just doing straight up rentals from local theaters or open spaces or what have you, whatever we can do.
And you you all do productions at Spark, at the Spark Theater, and
yes.
you do it at Center Stage, and I think I've even seen y'all out at Dogwood Dell.
Yeah, we kind of float between our permanent homes, I guess, if you could call it that. It would be with Spark's Black Box Space, and then Gottwald Playhouse at Center Stage. But then we do, you know, we do our bootleg at, well, it's now Virginia Rep. And we've done that at the Willow Lawn Space. And then this year we moved to the November Theater, which is formerly the Empire Theater. So there's that. And then we've had a really lovely relationship with Dogwood Dell, which is Richmond City Parks and Recs. That was our first home. We performed out at Pine Camp Cultural Arts Center for the first 3 years that we were in Richmond.
Which I'm guessing was kind of a challenge.
You know, it's a beautiful space. Mm-hmm. It really is a beautiful space. It's a little difficult to find, and it's not designed to be a theater per se. So it is a challenge in that way if you want to create a black box environment, which most of our plays fit well into. So you have to do a lot of kind of rigging of the space. But it was a great place to start out, and they're so welcoming and lovely. And so we've continued that relationship with them, doing shows in the summer, again, offering free theater.
Right.
To the city. We love performing at Dogwood Dell in the summer. It's such a thrill for us to do that.
I don't think it's necessary, really. Also, I think that going back to your earlier question about, you know, what have we learned, I think, is that we don't necessarily have to have a permanent home with the same urgency that we used to. I think that what we've gotten really good at, probably one of the biggest tricks with any arts organization, is telling your story to the community and getting your story out there. And that's, I think that's what's, you know, that's been a pretty major contributor to our growth over the last few years, is honing that skill.
Not that we wouldn't want a permanent home. We do want a home.
Right. If anybody listening has a home that they'd like to donate.
Please call us at.
Well, before we talk a little about the new season, let's just remind the audience of some previous Henley productions. Several of them have been enthusiastically received by audiences and critics. So what are some of your favorites that you've done over the past five seasons, I guess?
There's many. You know, I lovingly call our first season the put on a play in the backyard season.
My uncle's got a barn.
Exactly. Yeah. We had this great idea. Let's put on a play. You know, I think Richard III was James' first play with us. He was not the artistic director at the time. Alex was. He was a guest director with us. And Scotty Wichman came to play with us. And I think that was the first time that I saw the possibility of what we could become. And I look back at that piece, and that was the first time.
And you said True West was something of a...
I loved True West. Was a gorgeous piece of theater directed by Bo Wilson, who's an artistic associate with us. Also, you know, there was a time in that second season, which Richard III and True West were a part of, that we kind of realized that we had a reason for being here and that people wanted us here in Richmond. You know, you want to make sure that you're putting out a product not for yourself, but for the community, and that it's wanted and needed. And I think that was the first time for me during that course of that second season that I went, okay, there's the purpose. And it kind of grew from there.
Well, have you ever had a production where on opening night you just know you have a stinker?
Oh.
It's not ever going to get any better.
Never.
Either. Do you have to make a statement when you're opening a season? Do you look for a crowd pleaser or something that people know before you maybe hit them with the heavier stuff? How does that work?
We do have a commitment to doing a Shakespeare piece. One Shakespeare piece every year. We want to do something that has a bit of a, you know, familiarity to audiences that we can sort of put our trust in, that will build in a little bit of revenue for us. And then we try to bring in something that people are not familiar with, something that's newer, a little more exciting, hasn't been produced in the area before. that's a pretty exciting thing.
Well, talk about the Richmond theater audience a bit, because they sometimes get a bad rap for only wanting safe things. Mm-hmm. Is that a good mm-hmm. characterization, or you think that's not quite fair?
I don't know. It's, you know, there's naturally, you know, in a town that has a company as large as Virginia Rep, I mean, you know, that's just the nature of the game. They're the big dog in town. And so, you know, with that comes a pretty enormous following. But there's lots of great theater companies in town that have their own followings. I mean, Firehouse Theater, Richmond Triangle Players, you know, Richmond Shakespeare, African American Rep, all of us, I think, you know, those are the people that are probably closer to our size and our kind of following and our mission, which is less commercial and more geared towards achieving very specific mission objectives.
Yeah. It's always it's my favorite time of year when James and I sit down and we have this pool of plays that we're looking at. And it's also my most dreaded time of year too, because we'll inevitably, you know, we both have shows that we just love, but when you're looking at the whole season, you have to look at the umbrella. You know, you want to stay afloat, so you do have to have that balance that James talks about. So, you know, for example, last year when we were picking the season, there were two plays that we both loved so much, but they both involved a theme around children dying. And and I finally looked at James and I said, you know what? We just can't have two shows in a season where we kill off children.
Right,
so
right,
we have
right.
to pick one. So, you know, you get into
She had a point.
I did. Yeah. You know, I'm just thinking there's only so much you can stretch the Richmond audience.
Which one of my children about my children dying
exactly.
do I pick? Yes.
Yeah. You know, so we have these kind of funny conversations around that where we might have to put a play, you know, on the back burner for a little while that we just adore because it just doesn't fit into the pattern of the season. Yeah.
And because we're homeless, you know, we also have to pick the right show for the space.
Right.
And that is a massive consideration.
Yeah, having one of those plays at Spark, for instance, kind of gives an extra layer of
correct.
Of meaning. Yeah.
Correct. Exactly. So
well, this season starts off with the search for signs of intelligent life in the universe. I can tell you guys are really excited about this. It's a one-woman production. Tell us about the play and the origins. Who's playing the lead role?
The actress, only role. Her name is Eva DeVirgilis. She's originally a New Yorker. She moved to Richmond a couple of years ago and hasn't done very much in town. She's done a lot of camera work. She's done very little theater, but she's, I'm pretty sure, about to explode in this town. She is one of the funniest people, let alone most talented performers I've seen in a really long time.
She what a demanding role, though.
Oh, huge amount of text. You know, she's portraying 14 different characters. You know, it's a 2.5-hour show. It's, and you know, she slips in and out of these roles with such phenomenal energy and creativity. It's
right. Well, the director for this is Lane Satterfield, right?
Yes.
And is this the first time that this very well-known regional actress is done.
I think she's directed some stuff. She hasn't directed a lot. She came forward and threw her hat in the ring. You know, about 10 minutes into the conversation, I realized that she was the perfect person to direct this. Yeah. Yeah, she's having a great time.
What else is on tap this season? The Search for Signs, it opens December 6th, but what else is on tap?
After that, we have Faith Healer by Brian Friel, one of my favorite plays. That's going to be part of the Acts of Faith Festival this year.
Is it a comedy or a drama?
It's a drama. There is some humor in it, but It's a pretty heavy piece and pretty demanding of the audience. A lot of very dense language, a lot of storytelling.
Right, y'all don't shy away from that.
Exactly.
I was privileged to coach the Yellow Man, which was extremely moving, but had some incredibly painful moments. This was last season.
Yeah, I like to think that even if you walk out of a Henley comedy, that you're going to walk out talking about it. I think that's what makes us a little different. In that
I was going to say, is there a Henley Street type of play? Is there something that you'd specifically look for when you're picking the material?
Yeah, I mean, it's our mission states, you know, our artistic values are guided by three core standards: a reverence for language, a commitment to diversity, in a spirit of adventure. So we try to pick plays that are dynamic and rooted heavily in masterful language and, you know, a little off the beaten path.
I was also really impressed with, you asked me to participate in one of these, the after the show discussions. Will you be doing any more of those for these productions coming up?
Yeah, we call those our fourth wall talkback series, mm-hmm. and I love doing those. I wish we could do them every night, but it doesn't necessarily work out for every play, but we definitely commit to them after each Sunday matinee mm-hmm. performance, and we always have two Sunday matinees for each show. And it's an opportunity to talk about some perspective of the play with the actors, usually the director, usually some guest panelists, and then the audience. And, in the beginning when we started doing these, we thought, 10, 15 minutes. And they end up going on for well over half an hour to an hour sometimes. People really want to talk.
I was impressed that people didn't leave, that they stuck it out. It was a part of the show, really.
Yeah, it's really dynamic, and they're always different. And we try and think of, out-of-the-box kind of conversations, mm-hmm. not just mm-hmm. what's the play about, but just, something inherent in the play that, mm-hmm. that needs to be talked about. And our last show of the season, The Beauty Queen of Linan, will also be probably a very personal story for a lot of our audience.
I can't let you guys go without talking about the bootleg Shakespeare productions you do, which should actually do these all the time. They're so popular, right?
Yeah, we do one a year. And we've gathered a pretty sizable cult following.
Mm-hmm. Now set the scene. What are you doing here?
Exactly? What happens is we assemble a cast 30 days before the performance. I give them their roles, and they have 30 days to prepare the role independently. They learn their lines. They gather costumes and props and ideas. There's no rehearsal. We get together on the day of the performance at 8 a.m., bright and early, and we stage it in a day. We take an hour and a half dinner break, and we put it up that night to a free audience. It's a free offering to the community, and people go crazy for it.
Sounds like a recipe for a disaster.
It is a recipe for disaster, but it's also a recipe for some of the best theater you'll ever see.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been talking to Jackie O'Connor and James Ricks there with the Henley Street Theater Company. The theater company's sixth season will kick off next week with Jane Wagner's The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe. That's going to open up at the Dorothy Gottwald Playhouse at Center Stage on December 6th. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And that's our show for Friday, November 30th, 2012. I'm Don Harrison, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey, Amy Daniel, and Mike McKenzie. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi. And our board op? Well, they'll soon reveal themselves. Got a news tip? Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. And we'll see you here next week for another edition of Open Source RVA. Crack, baby, crack. Show me your reality. Smack, baby, smack. It's a holiday.